There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Humans Access Manchester with me, Clint Boone. Every week we celebrate the spirit of Manchester by speaking to somebody who's helped shape the city. This week I'm joined by a legendary guitarist and founder of one of the most influential bands the world has ever seen, Mr. Johnny Marr. Johnny talks about how the punk revolution of 1976, and in particular the Buzzcocks, inspired him to pursue his dreams.
And I was just like, oh, okay, Mancunian bands can do it. That was just amazing for me.
And he describes the magical moment where he met Morrissey for the first time.
Knocked on the door and his sister came knocking on the door, and then he came down, and then I just went, band, amazing guitarist. Amazingly, he just said, come in.
Gives me great pleasure, immense pleasure, to welcome to Humans Access Manchester an old friend of mine who carries with him probably the most incredible CV of any guest on the podcast so far in terms of musicians, and quite simply one of the greatest guitarists for our lifetime, and in recent years, an amazing frontman and all-round top rock star, Johnny Marr.
Hiya, Clint. How are you? Thanks very much for that.
I always like to do a nice introduction.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it gets a bit catty.
Yeah. I can go home now. Thanks very much. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you. You're looking good as always.
I feel all right. You know, it's good sort of getting, I'm sort of getting back to work a little bit after having all of a month off, I think, you know. So we're touring up until end of last year, and now I'm sort of, you know, back in rehearsals and cracking the whip and plugging things into things and, you know, getting ready to go out. It isn't a real, I don't feel, it's not a job.
And as ever, looking good. I want to talk about your lifestyle as well, because you've been clean living for many years, and we'll talk about that later on. We're going to talk about some aspects of your career, obviously. We're going to talk about Manchester, so that's the main reason we're here to do this. But let's start the beginning of your story. Tell us where and when you were born. I believe it was Hardwick, wasn't it?
Yeah, my parents came over in the early 60s from Kildare, Ireland, both my mum and dad. They were married very young, and I think my mum was 17 when I was born, 17, 18. So I was born in 1963 in Hardwick. And I was actually born in Longsight, but I grew up in Hardwick, couple of streets away from Manchester Apollo, just where the little park is, Higher Hardwick. And that was amazing. And I was the oldest. I've got a sister who's 11 months younger, and then a younger brother who came along 9 years later. And I was surrounded by a migration of very young and very numerous, a massive extended Irish family.
Yeah.
So in short, all of these, my mother's from a family of 14, my dad's from a family of 5, and their brothers and sisters all migrated, pretty much all of them migrated over to Manchester at the same time. So the Mars and the Doyles, this community, lived within a few streets and around the Longsight and Hardwick area. And I was one of the very first born, so I had like just loads of little cousins and running around. And I feel like I actually don't really remember hearing a Mancunian accent from a child or an English accent from a kid until I was 7 or 8. I mean, obviously I went to school with, you know, English kids, but it was just Ireland. It's like a mini island, yeah. But with that came an absolute massive obsession with music and records. And with them, because they were young, sometimes people get the impression that it was tin whistles and you know, fiddles and all of that. But because my parents were young, they were into rock and roll music and the pop music of the day. And the thing about Manchester was that they absolutely adored arriving in Manchester. They loved Manchester and they still do.
Yeah.
So I was brought up with a real super, almost over, you know, super appreciation in Manchester that my Mancunian mates, parents who would, and grandparents who'd gone through the war, almost took for granted.
Yeah.
So me and my sister were brought up with this uber appreciation of Manchester because they saw it as this great city that gave them opportunity, gave them work. Interestingly enough, was very, very welcoming to immigrants, whether it was from West Indian and Caribbean and Irish, Polish, European. You know, where I lived in Hardwick, it was very culturally diverse. And yeah, so I grew up in that kind of real melting pot of mostly Irish, but obviously very, very working class and you know, pretty skint, you know.
It sounds like St. Patrick's Day every day. That's, was it like that?
Yeah, and particularly most nights as well. But that's where I got on my musical, my love of music from being a real little kid, seeing, really watching this behaviour of these adults who, I'd never seen anyone play a song, a record, 15 times. I was watching my mother do that. But watching that enthusiasm and that wonder when my mum was playing an Everly Brothers record, it stuck with me, you know. I don't know whether you're like that, but
I do remember that vividly. My mum and dad had the old radio, or stereogram, as it was called back then. And I remember the effect that the records they played had on them as growing
yeah,
up. So, you know
yeah,
I mean?
Exactly, yeah.
They put Tom Jones on it, they'd be singing along and dancing and Shirley Bassey and then something by the Beatles or whatever. But I just remember being mesmerised by, not just by the music I was hearing, but the effect it had on the parents and the family around me. What did your mum and dad do for work?
My dad laid gas pipes, you know, in the roads. So he'd get out with his mates out of a van around, everywhere around, a lot around Merseyside, actually. He'd get in the van at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, and he'd drive over to Liverpool, which he loved. And then, you know, a place like all around the Greater Manchester area. Him and his usually Irish mates would get out of the van and load a load of stuff on the road, and then they'd dig it down like 4 or 5 feet and put gas pipes in. And he did that every day he could. We couldn't stop him when it came to him retiring. We had to force him to stop work.
Kept digging holes in garden.
Because they, I mean, they do say that about the Irish, though, don't they? That the English work to live and the Irish live to work. So that's what he did. And my mum did all kinds of different jobs. When I was little, she did some sort of cleaning work and worked in a bar. Yeah, she did that. Both of them were working. My mum did a couple of different jobs at the same time. And later on in my life, she started working for Hertz Rent-A-Car and Barclays Bank and stuff like that. She did more sort of clerical work. But when I was young, she cleaned rich people's, or more, you know, middle-class people's houses. Right? So I grew up with a very, very strong work ethic, particularly as I'm the oldest. It didn't ever occur to me that you would loaf about.
Same here. I think that's most working class kids of our generation were like that. They're just watching mum and dad graft the bollocks off year after year.
Yeah.
I think that's what still is instilled in us even today, isn't it?
And that went into me, you know. So when I got older, it was made very, very clear to me in my early teenage years, because the Dole was still a thing then. It was an option, but Dole and me living in their house was not an option.
It's funny, isn't it? That's how it was, isn't it?
So I always had this sort of looming threat hanging over me that if I did leave school early, which I did, I'd better get a job.
Yeah. At what point did you start playing guitar? I know you moved to Withenshaw around, you were 10 years old roughly.
Yeah.
And you were already playing guitar by then, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I got my first guitar when I was 5, which was a little toy thing just round off Higher Hardwick. And I've no idea, and no one knows why I was so obsessed with getting this little toy, but I was absolutely adamant that I had to get it. And I would stand outside the window, like, you know, just mesmerised by this little toy till my mother bought it, this little wooden thing. And I carried that around. Then I started playing properly when I got an acoustic guitar when I was 8. And I could hold down chords on that, and, you know, you could make music on that. So I started playing when I was eight really, yeah, because you couldn't stop me once I got a guitar. It wasn't practice, it was fun, you know. So I started when I was 8, and then I started getting, you know, good enough about 18 months later, I think, or a year later, something like that. So I've been playing quite a long time, yeah.
So by the time you got to Withenshaw, you were a bit exotic. You had longer, you had a guitar, you were only 10, and you knew how to play guitar. And then people started there.
Well, the truth of it, actually,
around with you.
Yeah, well, funny enough, in Hardwick, it was rough, you know, in the late 60s. It was pretty edgy. I had a great childhood because it was exciting. I wasn't miserable. Living so close to the city centre. I mean, I've always called town, you know. I think I used to make that the measure of a Mancunian. You know, if you refer to town as Manchester, I think you're not a Mancunian. But no, because it was literally, you know, from the Apollo, so it was 10 minutes walk. So that was our local shops, pretty much, or Stockport Road. So, you know, my childhood was, I was in town all the time with my mum, either, you know, being dragged around, or then when I was old enough to just go in there all the time on my own. So I've had this real close relationship with the city centre all my life. And then when we moved, we were part of that relocation drive in the 1973, where lots of people got moved from Moss Side and Longside, and in our case Hardwick, and we got moved out to Withenshaw. And when I moved out to Withenshaw, I have said it before, but it was like I'd moved to Beverly Hills, you know. I've never seen so many trees in my life, you know. But to answer your question, I was kind of considered slightly exotic because no one really knew the real score, because up until that point I was very, very, very quiet, believe it or not.
Right.
And then so when me and my sister landed in Withenshaw and I went to a new primary school, because I'd played guitar and I turned up there not in a school uniform, everyone else was in uniform, I think my mum kind of missed the memo. So I turned up in, people from the 70s will remember this, so first me and my sister turned up more appropriate for a disco, really. So I walked in there with, like, you know, feather cut and what was called a star jumper, because it was a jumper with stars on, believe it or not, Oxford bags and all of that, and very, very super into clothes. I didn't go around telling people I played the guitar, but it just sort of came out that I played the guitar, and a teacher asked me to bring my guitar in and stuff. So they didn't know that I was very, very meek. So in a way, I invented myself from what was being projected at me. People assumed I was much more confident and groovy than I was, and I thought, all right, well, I'll just pretend to be that then. Yeah, exotic, because me and my sister had come from the inner city and I could play the guitar. So I just went with that and kind of almost reinvented myself, really.
It's that classic thing that people do when they go to university, isn't it?
One of the spin-offs now of social media, that my manager was telling me this, he's quite involved in behind the scenes in a few schools and colleges. And seeing as you brought this up, what's happening now because of social media is the opposite of what you just described, because people, when they arrive in at different schools and universities and jobs and everything, they have already been exposed, if you like, on social media. So if someone's gone through a phase where, let's say, they were a goth, or they were experimenting with the sexuality, or they want to be a poet, or what, your history follows you around now. And anyway, what my manager was telling me was that it's an interesting phenomenon, cultural phenomenon, whereby people are less likely to stick the head above the parapet. That there's a theory that it is creating a culture of conformity where everybody wants to look alike. Everyone is afraid to stick the neck out.
How did you get on at school? Did you do all right academically, or were you not?
Yeah, I did okay. I was bright enough, you know. I mean, my background was extremely Catholic.
Did you used to get the strap and all that, like I did?
Did you get the strap too?
My arse was red constantly, getting the plinths all over my arse, and my hands were... Yeah. Always getting it.
No, it was pretty brutal. I went through all of that. Back then, as some of your more vintage listeners will know that was the 11 plus, and to get into that was a really big deal. Whether you're going to go to a grammar school or a secondary school. Now the irony is that I wanted to go to a secondary school because all my mates went to a secondary school, and also secondary schools were mostly mixed gender. I didn't see an all boys school in my immediate future. And that sounded like not much fun to me, but,
I believe it wasn't.
That's what I found out.
I only found out on day one there was no girls going to be there. I'm just like, hang on, what, it's all boys? Nobody told me that.
Something wrong here. Has anyone noticed? In spite of, you know, every attempt that I made to mess up the 11 plus, I passed the 11 plus, so my parents, that was, you know, I'd made it then. So I went to what was called St. Augustine's in Charleston. I just thought it was really going to be dead boring, you know, and I'd grown up with so close to my sister. Me and her used to, you know, go everywhere together. We were good mates. It was a little bit of a shock to the system, and he was extremely Catholic, and therefore it just put me off religion, you know. Mm. But I did all right. I was so hell-bent already by then on being a musician, and as it with every passing week, my interest was in anything that wasn't connected with either football or music. And being a musician, that was always secondary to me, really. So my social life and everything I did was always geared around learning to play the guitar better. Nothing got in the way of, no matter what, football, the pub, anything, parties. It was everything was secondary to me, what I think was like trying to learn my craft, really.
Yeah, and listening to a lot of music as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We'll talk about punk in a minute, but what was the music leading up to punk? So again, that early 70s thing, what was the music that was most inspiring to you at the time?
Well, glam rock, 100%. And luckily, what was the pop music of the day, literally the same as what would be played on Radio 1 now, was usually built around guitar. So my generation, it was bands like The Sweet, T-Rex were my absolute first love and real major obsession. Anything going that was... particularly if it had guitar on it, but you know, all those glam rock records, Suzy Quatro, Mudd, Wizard, Slade, Elton John, all of those real major glam rock stars.
I'm smiling because all those were on my list of favourite bands, but my big favourite band was Shwaddy Waddy.
Is that right?
You'll remember them, won't you?
Hey Rock and Roll.
Yeah. But because I'd grown up being a little bit older than you, only 4 years old or something, but I grew up loving 50s rock and roll music. That was my main love through the early 70s. But Little Richard, Jerry Lee, Elvis, Bill Haley, I was never going to see them because it was a previous generation that had gone pretty much. And all those bands you mentioned there, they were paying homage to the 50s, as you know. And then suddenly Shwaddy Waddy, they looked the part as well, didn't they? They looked great.
Yeah.
Two drummers, two bassists, two guitarists, two singers. It was two bands that became one, you know that.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, that's what happened, yeah.
Really?
So they're both based in there. Is it Leicester from? There's two rock and roll tribute bands.
Dave Bartram, yeah.
Fighting for the same audience all the time. And somebody came up with the idea of merging into one big band, which is why they had two drummers, two bass, two guitars, two singers.
Right.
Shwaddy Waddy.
I did not know that. Right. Still I've together, learned something.
So. I've been turned down twice in recent years for when I've approached people and suggested mad things. One was the Teletubbies. They fucked me off. And Shwaddy Waddy fucked me off as well. Just a little funny little film we wanted to make. I'll tell you about it afterwards. So I've been turned down. I got turned down by Shwaddy Waddy and the Teletubbies. If they hear this, they might be able to
follow. Hey, where are they now, Clint?
Yeah, you
look
know
at
I mean?
You. Look at you, mate.
Absolutely. Let's talk about that magical moment. 1976 came along, summer to late 1976. I was 17, living in Oldham. You were 13, 14.
Yeah.
Living in Withenshaw. And that's where the punk thing happened, isn't it? How did punk affect you? How did punk change your life, Johnny?
It affected me in the Buzzcocks. I saw that I could do it. Also, for me as a guitar player, my next big jump was seeing Marquee Moon, the television album cover as well. I mean, aside from the amazing music on it, but it was a Xerox. I mean, back then, Xerox machines were like really modern. And I'd never seen a cover with a distorted picture like that. Because Spiral Scratch, I did know that... it was four lads freezing cold on the steps of a statue in Piccadilly Gardens.
That's right.
You look at these people who are like, you know, you could bump into in Virgin Records or whatever, and you're thinking, not only have they actually made a record, which up until then was seemed like, you know, an impossible thing, but it's actually cooler than all these really expensive slick things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was so liberating, and it's from Manchester. I mean, truth be told, I was quite surprised when Nevermind the Bollocks came out because it sounded so layered and I wasn't expecting it to sound quite... I mean, it's an amazing record, but I really loved Spiral Scratch. I thought it was great. And then the next big thing for me was shot by both sides, by a magazine. So that was the main message that it sent out to me, like, whoa, hang on a minute, Mancunians can do it. And then the Buzzcocks running with the ball like that, and they were on the top of the pops all the time. And I was just like, oh, okay, they're on a major label, so Mancunian bands can do it. That was just amazing for me.
What about your first gig? What was the first show that you ever went to? Can you remember?
The first show that I ever went to, I worked some of this stuff out when I did my autobiography. It was Slaughtering the Dogs at the Wythenshawe Forum, and I was 12, and I went on my own, and it absolutely kicked off after probably the third song. I mean, it was like so on the cards, because their gigs were quite violent, you know. The actual real Slaughtering the Dogs were a bunch of lads from South Manchester, from Wythenshawe, and they were like the local heroes, and they played glam rock, but because they were young, they did it in this really youthful and irreverent way, and they were really on the cusp of punk. And what they did then, when punk happened, understandably, they basically sped a lot of the songs up and just said 1, 2, 3, 4 before them. They were housing estate glamour, and it was quite an interesting thing. So that was my first ever show.
Obviously, you lived in the shadow of, or you grew up in the shadow of the Apollo, didn't you? And during the punk era, when you started going to gigs illicitly, because you're probably underage or couldn't afford it, but you used to have a secret way of getting in, didn't you? Which you probably, do you ever still use that method now?
Well, there's a drain pipe outside the girls' toilets of the Apollo. And so what we used to do, you'd see a few girls. So me and my mate would ask one of the girls, like, listen, you know, will you open the window, that little window up there? And then when the support band had come on, one of us, usually me, would have to climb up this drain pipe and squeeze into this tiny, tiny little window. And as you were getting in, there'd be usually quite a few shrieks and screams from coming inside the girls' toilets. And then you just leg it, and then you run all down this labyrinth of stairs, which is in the backstage area, right? I now have discovered. And then to this doorway, and then you'd open the doors and your mates would pile in.
Yeah.
But you know what, though? Have you seen how high that window is?
I've seen it, because you told me about it before. It's
well high.
Shocking.
Yeah. So, but the thing, you know, the things you do for rock and roll.
Yeah.
But what, you know, what used to happen was that, you know, a bunch of lads, usually, we used to congregate behind those doors at the Apollo, and definitely at the Free Trade Hall. And no matter who was on, I'm not alone in saying this, I used to go and see, and whoever was on, I would go and see. It didn't matter. I saw so many bands that I just, you know, don't care for.
Yeah.
And loads of other lads did the same. We always got in, one way or other, by hook or by crook. I never walked away from one of those gigs never getting in, and I saw so many bad groups.
Let's talk about a chap that a lot of our listeners might not be familiar with, a bloke that I knew. A man who you met before the Smiths, even, when you were selling clothes at X-Clothes. Talk about Joe Moss. It's a chap that the man in the street probably won't be generally aware of. But
yeah,
tell us about Joe Moss.
Well, Joe was a very interesting character. He'd made a life for himself during the 60s in and around Manchester. It started off with a stall on some market that used to be the underground market off Market Street.
Yeah.
He started off like making hippie sandals and stuff like that. And then that expanded. He was involved in the Eighth Day, which is still there now. And then people from the 70s will know of his shops, which were called Crazy Face. But anyway, when I met him, I was 17 and I was working on Chapel Walks in town. He had Crazy Face shop next door. And I used to nip in there for a cig. And the girls in there were great. They were good fun and they were good to hang out with. So I used to go in there. And the shop had what now you call retro culture. So the shop had loads of old pictures of James Dean and Marlon Brando and Marilyn Monroe and all these old 60s movie stars, which then was really unusual, and it was super hip because CDs weren't even out then. I used to go into the shop, and I'd yet to meet Joe. I used to hang out with the girls in there. I'd say, "Why? What's this music? John Lee Hooker and Solomon Burke and all of this, Van Morrison." And, oh, Joe makes us listen to it. So I was intrigued to meet this guy, Joe. Anyway, I walked in there one day on my lunch break, and I saw this guy. He would have been in his mid to late 30s, which to me was ancient. And I stuck my hand out and said, "Oh, you know, my name's Johnny. I'm a frustrated musician." From that moment on, he became like a sort of father figure to me, a mentor. And I was just like this. I was like a sponge, just kind of crazy. I just soaked all of this stuff up. Mm. And he was my new best mate. It was unusual. Over the years, he encouraged me to form the Smiths. So it was me and Angie, my now wife, my girlfriend, and Joe. That's how the Smiths started.
Right.
Joe was my manager right up until the night he died, which is in 2015, after our very last gig of the tour.
Wow.
Yeah, he hung on there to the very last gig. Yeah. So my new studio is called the Crazy Face Factory in tribute to Joe.
You knocking on Morris's door, it was Joe Moss that persuaded you to give that a shot, wasn't it?
Yeah. I was just a kid with a guitar. I didn't have a band, but he knew that I was going to form one. I mean, I'd been in a bunch by then. He and I were very into, when I met him, I was very, very into the Brill Building, New York songwriter scene of the mid-60s. You know, when you were talking earlier about liking rock and roll music, going back retrospectively and getting into Jerry Lee and all of that, I did that in my way, going back to the girl groups. The reason I got into the girl groups was because of my heroes, because of Patti Smith. She used to do Ronette songs, and the Dolls used to do Shangri-La songs, and that was my introduction to that music. And then, much probably like yourself with 50s music, when I heard that music, it sounded more radical than the music that was being made for my generation. At that time in 1982, the South Bank Show was one of the few places where you would see music on the television. And there'd been a documentary about the songwriting duo of Lieber and Stoller. And Joe, anyway, actually sat me down and said, watch this. And he put the VHS in. And I was watching this thing. I was absolutely fascinated. I'd like Lieber and Stoller. But then about midway through it, or early on in it, whatever, he said to me, well, watch this bit. I think it's Jerry Lieber, I think, says to the camera, he says, well, I needed someone to write words. I didn't know anyone, but I'd been told that there was this kid in the neighbourhood who wrote words. So I just went and knocked on his door. And then I realised that because I'd been talking to Joe about, I'd mentioned that I'd heard of this guy Morrissey from years before who'd been in punk bands. And it had come up in conversation, well, I don't know who this guy is. And Joe was just planting that seed in my mind. That's what you should do. Just go and knock on the door, you know. Mm. Lieber and Stoller did it. So I went back to my mum's place in Wythenshaw, and I tracked down a lad who lived nearby who knew Morrissey and said, have you got his address? First off, I asked someone else, did they have Morrissey's number? And they said, no. This guy, Phil Fletcher, said, no, but Steve Promfort will. So then I had to get Pommy's address, go out of Pommy's and knock on his door. Did a lot of knocking on doors when I was young. And I remember it so well because it was a sunny day in Manchester. So we all remember those days, right? Beautiful, scorching day. And then Steve Pomfret opened the door, asked him, did he have Morrissey's address? And he hadn't seen Morrissey for years. And he went, oh, yeah, hold on a minute. I think I've got it somewhere, yeah. So he went off down the hall, stood at the front door. And he came back and handed me the piece of paper. He wrote the address down, King's Road in Stretford. And then I walked down a little garden path and I stood outside on the pavement, this boiling hot sun. And I looked at this white, whited out piece of paper. I can remember it like it was yesterday. And I had one of those moments. I've been very fortunate to have a few of them in my life where I was like, this is a moment. You know, I kind of am a little bit partial to that mystical stuff anyway. I don't know whether you've ever noticed, Clint. but I'm pretty cosmic sometimes. But it really felt like something was going to happen when I was holding that bit of paper. It felt like a magical object. Anyway, I thought, right, I'll just go and knock on his door. So, but I bottled it at the last minute. And I said, Pommy, you got to come with us. Because I've heard he's a bit unusual. And I can't just go and knock on his door. I've knocked on two doors already today. So we got on the bus and went to Stretford and walked up Morrissey's tiny little garden path and knocked on the door. And his sister came and opened the door and said, who are you? So I said, well, Stephen in. And then he came down and then he let on to Pommy, and then I just went, band, amazing guitarist. And and amazingly, he just said, come in. And then we went into his room, and Pommy sat in the corner, absolutely still, but beaming, you know, watching something very significant. And it did feel very significant. And a lot of things that happened in my life felt very significant at that time, as I said, and they turned out to be significant, you know. Mm. It must have been very, very peculiar, weird for him, because he was just going about his day and then this little hyperactive tornado, albeit who knew what he was talking about, completely out of nowhere. You know, he had no warning. I'm in his bedroom and I'm playing his 45s, this complete stranger, amazing, albeit very stylish one. Anyway, you know, I could go on, but and someone could make a film of it.
Yeah, but I was going to say, have you seen the film?
I've not, you know what?
Because that scene there, you know, it's just, I know you've not seen the film, but that scene, as you described, is replicated really well in the film, I think.
Oh, good.
It's a good film. We're talking about the film England Is Mine that came out a couple of years ago. What was, I mean, the Smiths' success came, as we all know, we don't have to go through that in fine detail at
this
point.
Thank God.
But what was the moment where you thought everything I ever dreamed of as a kid in Hardwick and in Withinshaw, it's all, that's it, it's all happened, I've got it all. What was that? Was that moment?
Yeah.
Was it Top of the Pops?
No, it was before that. It was standing on what used to be the approach of Piccadilly train station. What's the back? Now the back of Piccadilly train station. That used to be the front. That thing that used to slope.
Yeah.
And I went to pick up a box of 25 copies of Hand in Glove, which was our first 7-inch single on Rough Trade, one Monday morning.
From the post office, from parcel collection place.
Yeah, from the parcel collection place, yeah. Because I was besotted from being a child with making a 45 RPM single. Mm-hmm. When Morrissey and my first proper get-together, after I knocked on his door, the very next time we went, which was a week later for our first songwriting session, I had a little bit of a rant, and I said, right, what we should do is we should have our first single should have a navy blue label with it, silver writing, in a picture sleeve, should be on Rough Trade, and then we should write a song for Sandy Shaw, and the first album should, I mean, this mad stuff all happened, and then our first album should just be eponymous, it should just be called The Smiths, and yeah. I had this long list, like a checklist, of what we should do, and it completely, you ask Morrissey this, he'll tell you, everything happened. I mean, it was so fanciful. It was like some weird kind of divining prediction, but it did happen, you know, yeah. Because I thought about my band having whoever it was going to be, I just wanted this navy blue label with silver writing on it. And subconsciously, it was because of the Rolling Stones Decca records that I'd grown up loving as a kid. And anyway, so when I got Hand in Glove and I got the box and I stood up outside Piccadilly Station one Monday morning and I opened it and pulled this record out, it was almost too much to take in, really. And then the Top of the Pops thing was just, that was a real sensory overload, you know. We'd booked a gig at the Hacienda that night as well, and we'd sort of exploded on the scene and everything was all about us and this charming man and everyone was like talking about us and suddenly everyone was dressing like us and all of this. And because Top of the Pops was live, we'd done it and it seemed like every kid in the country had tuned in to see it and was suddenly at that moment then raiding their mothers and sisters' bedrooms for blouses and beads and flowers and all of that. And we then got on the train to go back to play the Hacienda that night. So our working day wasn't done and we'd been aware that we'd like set off this bomb. I mean, it sounds a little immodest, but I was aware that. I thought no one's seen anything like that on the
absolutely.
Telly.
Because at the same time a lot of people started celebrating it from second one, but a lot of people were looking at telly shouting, what is he doing with fucking flowers? Weren't they? You know what I mean? There's a bit of rage as well from certain quarters.
Well, it was great. I love that we would polarise people all the way through the career, and we got more and more polarising, but still do, you know.
especially your mate.
We had to get the train back. So the size of that event for all of us, it would have been enough and massive and to get our heads around if we'd recorded it as you usually did on a Wednesday and then we all got together in my flat or whatever or in our houses with our families and watched ourselves on the TV. That would have been a big deal as it was, but it wasn't. We did it and then we were all on the train going back to play the Hacienda. And when we got off the train at Piccadilly, Mike Pickering and Rob Gretton, who was New Order's manager, came to meet us and they were white. The pair of them were absolutely ghostly white. And they went, there's 2,000 people in there and there's 1,000 people on the street on Whitworth Street. Don't know how we're going to get you in. It was total mania. And then we drove to the Hacienda. And I remember being lifted, Rob Gretton lifted me out through the crowd. And he had me almost a book. I mean, I was only 7'2" anyway, but which was handy. But he lifted me into the venue. And we went and we played this gig. And when we played that show, which was Total Mania, there was a kid about 2 feet away from me for the whole show with his shirt off, and he was just trying to get at me for the gig. It's on video somewhere, and he's trying to get me all the way through the show, and he's trying to attract my attention. And I thought, God, this is full on, this kid. And then I only realised, I don't know, 40 minutes into the show, that it was a kid I went to school with.
Right.
And I thought, this is mad.
And that image there, wanting to grab bits of you, for 3 years, that was what it was like. The Smiths became one of the most influential British bands of all time, as we know. It was a proper hurricane of madness for a few years. 1987, you opted out, you decided you had enough. Understandably, at the time, you were pretty much making all the management decisions. Everything to do with the running of the business was being put on you, on your shoulders. You were 23.
Yeah.
Still young bloke, really. And that's what it drove you to make the decision to get out of there, didn't
it? Yeah, well, obviously, it could be a very, very complicated answer. But the thing is that my role when we formed was that, you know, I went and got everybody. So the other members of the band didn't know each other, for example. It wasn't like we were a bunch of mates. So none of us knew each other. But I got Mozza, and then I got Mike, and then I got Andy. So in a way, I was like the spoke in the middle of a wheel, really. And then I got our rehearsal room. This isn't like a list of my achievements. It's just my role in the band. I got the rehearsal room, and I got Joe, the manager. And then I went to Rough Trade to get the deal. It was just the way I was, you know. I don't begrudge anyone that. I was very resourceful, and I had a lot of passion, and I had a vision, and I formed the group. So my role was to get the rehearsal rooms, get the studio, get the label, get the manager, all of that. And that role stayed and stayed, but we got huge, and we, you know, we're playing to thousands of people in America and doing these, what they call sheds, these outdoor arenas and stuff, on tours without a manager, because, you know, Joe had left, been forced out, actually, and then several other managers had been forced out, as everybody knows. So if you fast forward then, after having done Meat Is Murder, which was a number one album, straight in number one, The Queen Is Dead, which is considered as, you know, one of the most important albums, and which really nearly killed all of us making it, particularly me, then Strange Ways, and then all the singles and all of that, 70-odd songs, and we became this huge group. My role was expected, or it was put back on me, that my role would be as it used to be. Now, running around getting rehearsal rooms in Manchester and blagging studio time is one thing, but talking to lawyers about leaving record companies and talking to accountants about tax laws that I didn't understand, and dealing with drug busts and dealing with agents and huge American tours, that was beyond my remit. At the time, it was a very... I felt incredibly... I was heartbroken, really, because I was put in that position, and I had no choice but other than to leave my band, you know, because I wasn't prepared to do that. You know, I'd have not been put in that position. Who knows, really? But I'm very, I'm quite a philosophical person, and you know, really, it was never really in my stars to... I didn't ever see myself being in REM or U2 or Coldplay or one of those bands who've been around for 40 years. What I've ended up doing is exactly really what I imagined I would do.
Because in hindsight, that period where probably, I'm guessing that would have been the low point of your working life, wasn't it, right after the Smiths, but ultimately, and probably in a short space of time, it seems like you must have felt liberated to be free of that and to be able to just get on and do what the hell you wanted.
As weird as it was, you know, as heartbreaking as it was, it was weird, because it was like a grief and simultaneously complete liberation. And joining the, because I'd already been really close with Matt Johnson, and joining that band was a real refuge for me, and then, you know, gave me plenty to think about. And I was in the for 4 years, nearly 5 years. And then also what happened then, to bring it back to Manchester, was within months afterwards, Madchester happened.
Yeah,
I was only 24, so this insane cultural explosion, this really exciting and I think very valid and significant revolution happened in my own town, you know, at the age of 25. So that took my mind off things, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Because this is still Johnny Marr, the party animal, wasn't it?
but, you know, I mean, and that's around the time we met, wasn't it?
Yeah,
you know, about 88, You know, everyone wanted to be Mancunian. And electronic, you know, me and Bernard Sumner had just formed. So he was doing New Order and electronic, and I was doing the other in electronic. And we were using electronic as a refuge from our other bands, as well as being the most pioneering, I thought, electronic musician of his generation at that time.
With New Order.
With New Order. He happened to be one of the owners of the Hacienda. So that was a very, very creative and interesting and wild time.
Let's talk about the lifestyle. I mentioned earlier at the beginning about you've got a very healthy lifestyle now, the way you eat, you're vegan, you run 20 miles a day or whatever, you don't drink, you don't do the drugs or anything. Was there a turning point? Was there one moment where that happened, or was it just over a series of months or years?
Well, I got into the sort of, kind of running and all of that. That was a moment. That was when I went in the early 2000s. I went out with Angie, my wife, to Morocco to sort of get healthy because Kirsten McCullough died not long before, and that really had an effect on me. And then and I got ill, actually. I got pneumonia, got pleurisy, rather. I was feeling rough, so I went out to Morocco. And anyway, I did have a moment where I was sat on the top of what's called a Riyadh, and I looked out over the desert, really, and it was all pink as the sun was going down. I could see the silhouettes of these palm trees, and I'd always liked running. And in the 90s, I sort of got into sort of a bit of fitness, and I thought, oh, you know what, I really just feel like running out there, you know. And I got out and just started running, no music or no nothing, you know, just got my trainers on and just went for it. Because of what I do, being a musician, you know, sometimes with some journalists, it's nearly always journalists, when they ask me about not drinking, there's this sort of assumption that it's abstinence, or that I have this, my rock and roll hell years. Did all of that so young because, you know, as you pointed out, I was so young when the Smiths took off. So, you know, I became a successful musician at 19, 20, and more importantly, doing something I loved. That to me is success. Yeah. But I had all the trappings of success. And you know what? It was always on my to-do list, all of that stuff. Well, first off, have a great band, right? Take loads of drugs. Have the roadies all living, sleeping on your floor while you make a record, tick. Always wear sunglasses indoors, tick. Crash a car, tick, etc., etc. And I got to tick all of those things off and still be here. So then when I got in my late 30s or something, my mid-30s, I just didn't want to be an old cliche. It's about what makes me a better musician, keeps my attitude fresh, keeps my energy up and makes me want to work.
Yeah.
So if partying would make me a better musician, I'd do it. I've got no morality or any judgment about it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, you know. And I took to clean living like I took to dirty living.
You did some really cool stuff with Maxine Peake recently, didn't you?
Yeah.
That was brilliant again.
Yeah, well, the thing with Maxine was that it came, all my ideas are really always, they're never put together by a manager or by a record company. They're all these notions that I have. And what happened with Maxine was that I wanted to visualise or envisage a different kind of guitar music that I could do alongside Call the Comet, and that isn't about verses and choruses. So I had the idea, this feeling, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that'd be pretty good. And it kept coming back to me. And then once I decided I wanted to do it, within seconds, I just imagined Maxine Peake talking over it, because I'm a massive fan. Who isn't?
Yeah.
We got to meet. I didn't know her at that point. We got to meet and we just met up and had lunch and we were chatting about this, that and the other, all kinds of stuff. And then at the end of this meeting, I said, oh, I've got a confession, you know, to make. I've got this idea about in the future about doing this project.
Yeah.
And I'd love for you to do a track with me, you know. And she was on board. She was like straight away, like, and then this friendship developed. And I just got her to say some stuff into her phone, one of which was this reading this blog, The Priest, about a homeless guy. And then I got it in the studio and I just had Maxine's voice coming through the speakers. I tell you, that's a great experience.
Yeah.
Because she's so expressive and distinctive sounding. And and then we made this little film that's on YouTube for anyone who's interested, with Molly Windsor as acting as this homeless girl.
Let me talk about the collaboration with Noel, because you did a track with Noel on his recent album, yeah. If Love Is The Law. And that, not just the guitar on it, the harmonica on that, it's like, it makes the ears go up on me, my arms like that.
Yeah, well, I played it, but Noel had the vision for that. That was his thing, bring your harmonica down for this. And then,
you say, how is your harmonica?
No, I didn't, but I'm going from now on, every time I hear that, I'm going to think of you.
Can you remember last time I told you a joke? I didn't make this joke up, it's out there.
Was it the Marmite one?
Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't invent that.
I didn't invent it, no, I'm just saying. But when I told you, I don't think you knew it.
No, I think that was the first time I ever heard it. And I've heard it a lot since then.
Yeah.
You asked me, you set it up and I'll give
should
you.
Should do that, yeah. What does Morrissey have on his toast?
I don't know, but Johnny Marmite, see?
It's good.
Works every time.
They're laughing out there in podcast land, I tell you. I want to talk about Manchester. That's the main reason we're here now. So talk about the spirit of Manchester. What do you love about the spirit of this beautiful city?
Well, I think it's not for nothing that this city is built on immigration, I think. I really don't think you can talk about Manchester without referring to the Jewish community that came over from Eastern Europe and the Irish community and West Indian community, because those working class communities that came over and the Indian community with the Industrial Revolution, they needed entertainment. So, you know, there's also a reason why Manchester had more clubs per capita in this city than any other city in Europe in the 60s. So maybe because, you know, I come from an Irish family, it always felt like a very welcoming, diverse place to me. So the fact that a lot of comedians came out of here, and we all know tons of musicians and some great actors and so on and so on, is really born out of the working classes coming here for the Industrial Revolution, I think, and needing to entertain and be entertained. And that's really ingrained in us. The Industrial Revolution was seriously historically significant.
Pretty cool, wasn't it?
It was right where we are, you know. Yeah, pretty cool. Absolutely. It's a good way of putting it.
Absolutely. If I was to say to you, who are your favourite humans of Manchester of all time, past or present? Give us two or three names.
My mind goes to Bernard Sumner and Steve Morris, I think. But Bernard, he'd be right up there, really, because he was a guitar player in Joy Division, and the guitar playing's pretty great on those records. You know, he's led New Order. He's a great guy. And, you know, all the members of New Order, without them, no Hacienda, and that was such an important place for everybody, really. Bernard would take those plaudits very graciously, but then he would point out that, well, yeah, it's very nice, Johnny, but actually I'm from Salford.
Yeah, that's
from
right.
Salford. You know what the people from Salford are like?
Yeah, Uckie's the same, isn't he?
Don't make the mistake of giving them paying them the compliment of calling them Mancunians, but Bernard would be one. And Albert Finney, I think. Again, Salford.
Yeah. Joe Moss has got to be on your list.
Joe Moss would be the king of it, actually, because of all the things we talked about. And he's a great example of Mancunian bohemianism. He was the walking embodiment of rock and roll culture from the 50s through the 60s and the hippie movement and the mod movement and the hippie movement and the Northern Soul movement. And the whole pop culture from the 50s up until, well, you know, 2015.
There's a word for it, isn't it? It was a beatnik, wasn't he?
Exactly, yeah.
He was, as we remember that.
Manchester was, beatniks were very, very important in Manchester. Yeah.
Before you go, Johnny, describe Manchester in three words.
Industrial musical revolutionaries.
Fantastic. Johnny Marr, thank you for being a human of excess Manchester.
Thanks for including me in that list, Clint.
That was Johnny Marr. Make sure you join us next week, where I'll be speaking to photographer and graphic designer, most noted for working with bands like Oasis and The Verve, Brian Cannon. Don't forget to follow us on social media and subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester if you can. Rate us, feel free to leave us a comment. We love getting your feedback. And please share the podcast if you like it. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.